Oh my God, you're like listening to Good Day World with Cameron Riley on the Podcast Network. Whatever.
My guest today is Australian journalist, author, blogger, Anthony Lowenstein. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Thanks for having me.
Mate, your most recent book, The Blogging Revolution, I just finished reading this morning, actually, and you know, it's funny because it's not what I thought it was going to be. I had seen it talked about, and I'd seen it in bookstores, but not flicked through it. And I thought, oh God, another book on blogging. I mean, how many books on blogging really do we need? It wasn't until a friend of mine went and met you at a book signing, I think, that I actually dug into it and realized that it's not just a book about blogging. It's a book about how blogs are being used around the world, particularly in countries such as Iran and Saudi Arabia and Cuba and China, or not being used in some of those countries as a tool of dissent, of discussion, political debate and revolution. And it truly is a tremendous book. So first of all, congratulations and thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Now, I was hoping we could maybe talk a little bit about some of your experiences and drill down into it. And we might talk about some of these countries. And you, unlike many of us that write blogs, weren't content just to sit in your living room in your undies and proselytize. You actually got out and traveled to these countries over the last couple of years and tried to meet bloggers in each of these countries.
Yeah.
First of all, can I ask you, generally speaking, if you had to sum up in late 2008, is blogging actually having an impact in these countries?
Undoubtedly so. I think I should say in that mid-2007, I went to Cuba, Egypt, Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia and China. And I suppose as I try and explain the book, one of the things that really frustrated me about living in Australia, and I've been living in Sydney for the last 6 years or so, well, since 9/11 in 2001 and since the Iraq War, it just frustrated me no end that the kind of coverage we were getting of these countries, countries that are either regarded as allies of the West or enemies of the West, was very, very one-sided. So a country like Iran, for example, is regarded as an enemy of the West, and it's demonized regularly. Now, I'm not suggesting there's not massive human rights issues in Iran. Of course, there are, as my book talks about, but the situation is far more nuanced than we often get in our here or in much of the West. And blogs and online media there was one way to get inside that world. It's not the only way. But Iran, for example, was one of the most fascinating places. There are about 70 million people in the country, the vast majority of whom are under 30 years old. Many of them are online. Now, many of them are not engaging in political thought and content. In fact, many of them are not. But what's fascinating is the kind of debates that are going on there online, which there are red lines that people can't cross or shouldn't cross. You can't, for example, criticize the supreme leader who's the head guy in Iran. But you can generally talk about many things, despite the restrictions and despite the censorship. And it seemed to me that the only way to actually gauge about that kind of world was to go to a place like Iran, get in there and speak to writers and bloggers and dissidents and journalists and citizens and just average people, basically, who could give me an insight into a place that you read about every day in the media, but generally from a very, very skewed perspective.
You said in the introduction to the book that you believe that the mainstream media sees its role as reinforcing and defending the status quo defined by corporate invested realities. Now, I agree 100% with that, but it's unusual to hear a journalist say that. Usually journalists are all,
I know.
The integrity of the journalist.
Yes. Well, that's probably why I've got very, very few friends in the media, Cameron, to be honest. Look, I am not, I mean, I don't say this, you know, to sort of try and pat myself on the back, but I do have a very different view to my own profession and my own job than most other people in the profession. And I think that's because, A, I've never, I mean, I've worked in the media for a number of years, but I've never really accepted the idea that journalism or journalists themselves are somehow have this incredible repository of knowledge to sort of spread to the poor masses below. There's been a sense, I think, for a long time, this is before the internet and even more so now, that experienced person X writes an article in the paper, the general public reads that article and supposedly is awed by that person's intelligence or that person's idea, and therefore they regard themselves as inferior to that person. That's often not articulated like that. And the web, of course, as you would well know, and podcasting for that matter, has changed that relationship. And many journalists, despite what they say they love to engage the web, in fact are petrified they're petrified of the idea that their authority is being challenged. And for me, in fact, it's a great thing. Now, obviously, yes, I like to think that I have some experience in this issue, or I write a lot about Israel-Palestine, and I spent a lot of time in the Middle East. So, yes, I like to think I have more knowledge than an average person. That's true. But what I like to think also that I'm happy to be engaged and challenged and provoked on these kind of issues equally. And the reality is that the majority of journalists are not like that. And the web, I think, in these kind of countries that I went to, even more so in the West, the reality is the only sources of information that is often reliable or independent does come from online media, because state-run media, whether it's TV or newspapers or whatever, are essentially propaganda outlets that are just pumping out, you know, government spin. And I think we have this idea in the West that, oh, well, our media here is much more independent. Well, I'm not suggesting that, you know, we live in a totalitarian state. That's, of course, nonsense. But what is the case is that, and the Iraq War was a classic case of that in 2003 and 2002, where the run-up to the war, both within the US and elsewhere, there was, and there were exceptions to this, and there were journalists doing great work who were questioning the status quo position about WMDs with Saddam Hussein. Most of the media fell into line. They accepted government spin, they accepted government lies, and my view, and I talk about this in the book, the war would not have happened. In my view, the media had done its job. And the sad reality is here we are 5-6 years later. The media's learned nothing. And we're now ramping up, apparently, a war against Iran for the same spurious reasons. And although it's unlikely there'll be a strike against Iran, say, before the US election in November, nothing's impossible, although the financial meltdown probably makes that less likely. I think it's still quite likely to happen either under an Obama or a McCain presidency. So my point, I guess, is that despite the fact that 5-6 years ago, the media rolled over, essentially, for the Bush administration and the Blair government in Britain and the Howard government here. And the media's job is to be sceptical. Now, most journalists you speak to will say, yes, I am sceptical. They're sceptical within very, very set boundaries because they know what the boundaries are. And if they work for a mainstream news organisation, with exceptions, there are boundaries. And obviously, I publish in the mainstream media too, but as a freelancer and also as someone who doesn't really share many of those ideals, I think it's important that we actually understand what those boundaries are and we try to break them regularly.
It's what Noam Chomsky has referred to as not propaganda, but propaganda.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
So getting on to Iran, and I agree with you, Iran is a fascinating case, and you actually review a little bit of the history of American and British involvement in Iran, where they overthrew Mossadegh in the 50s and installed the nephew of the previous Shah. And you know, it's not many people seem to recall that history today and how that led directly to the rise of the Ayatollah Khomeini and Islamic fundamentalism in Iran in the 70s.
Very much so.
But you say that today they have there's nearly a million bloggers in Iran. Now, that number shocked me.
It's huge. Now, admittedly, a lot of those bloggers aren't necessarily writing every day. But I think, I mean, that's the kind of thing I guess I was trying to point out in the book and to try and explore that. And obviously, I only met a handful of those people. But one of the things I think that's astounding is that we have this sense in the West that our democracy and our media must be far more advanced than anything else in the so-called non-Western world. It's just an ingrained belief that most people have. And the reality is that would I rather live in Iran or Australia in terms of media? Probably here, because there are more freedoms here. There's no doubt about that. But the reality is that there is a great deal of diversity happening in Iran. And as I said, I was astounded to meet a number of people who would talk about the way in which the public and the private sphere in Iran is what makes the country fascinating and also very frustrating. If you walk down the street in Tehran or a major city, most men can generally wear what they want. There are certain restrictions in terms of clothing and hair length, but generally they're more free. Women, on the other hand, have to wear the hijab, which is like a headscarf, have to have their arms and legs covered, etc., etc. If, on the other hand, you go to someone's house and you close the doors and you see how people live normally, like in many countries, people are talking and writing and expressing themselves and dressing like they would really in Sydney or Brisbane or New York. It's similar. Now, of course, they're talking about different things to an extent, but the desire to talk about those issues, have freedom, drink alcohol, have sex, take drugs, be normal, be young, blog, is exactly the same. There's no difference. The difference is, of course, the context in which they do it. And one of the things that struck me was that the idea about in countries like Iran, that there are actually more people probably engaged in the political process in a place like Iran by necessity than there would be here. Now, there's no way to work out in Australia, for example, how many young people, you know, are engaged in politics or online political media. I don't know what the number would be. It's probably fairly small. I'd say out of 21 million people. In Iran, on the other hand, because the country is so full of extremes, and many people who, some of whom, of course, support the regime and some of whom don't, there's a great deal of debate between the so-called reformists and so-called conservatives, people often feel the need to engage and actually talk about issues. And that's, I think, also challenges our idea that, oh, every single person in a country like Iran must be this poor little man or woman who just sort of accepts authoritarianism. It's simply not true. But we rarely get a sense of that in our media here. So speaking to many bloggers there, there was an importance for them, I think, to try and tell me, as a Westerner, that we have a voice, we have an important voice. Admittedly, at the moment, a more reformist or liberal mindset is not in the ascendancy. The conservatives, under Ahmadinejad, who's the current president, is certainly the most powerful at the moment. And that's likely to probably continue for the foreseeable future. There's an election in Iran next year, and he's likely to probably win. I might be wrong, but he looks like he's going to win again. So it was important, I think, to say to people in the West, what voices aren't we hearing? Why aren't we hearing those voices? And also, as I say in the book, as you know, to sort of provoke and pressure Western journalists and media to give these people a voice. And I always, as I say throughout the book too, yes, I'm a Western journalist and I'm going to a place like Iran or Saudi Arabia, so clearly what I'm writing about is through my own lens or my own view. There's sort of no way to get around that. But at the same time, it was important actually to give those people, men and women, a voice to actually be heard in their own words, rather than always through my, you know, rather than through always my own perspective. And too much the Western media, when they go to a place like Iran, say, want to talk about officials, like officials said this or officials said that. Now, officials are not unimportant in any country, but there's this weird obsession in much of the Western media about getting an official view. So you might have an article in a major paper in the West about the US, for example, and half the articles are unnamed sources from government just sprouting off about something. There's never any questioning about that. It's just accepted that, well, that's the way news is produced. If, on the other hand, you wanted to speak to someone who's not an official, you have to sort of get clarification that person's trustworthy, whereas an official who's unnamed is supposedly inherently trustworthy. It's nonsense. So in Iran, for example, and other places I went to, talking to people who may be running under pseudonyms or for security reasons was interesting because they were able to construct an online identity, which I guess to some extent is not that different to here. The difference is that people often risk their life or risk a great deal of imprisonment for speaking out publicly about certain issues.
Here you just risk losing your job.
Indeed, indeed. Or, you know, or losing friendships or girlfriends or boyfriends or whatever. But yeah, certainly, yeah, in Iran you pay a high price.
Or your mum finding out you're injecting crack cocaine into your eyes.
For example, yeah. You know, which some mothers might endorse. It's hard to say. Mine probably wouldn't. No.
So in places like Iran, though, not all of the bloggers are against the current regime. Some are obviously in support of the regime.
Very much so. And I think that's also one of the fascinating things that I was discovering, that the conservatives in Iran and many authoritarian regimes have realized in the last 5 years that the web, in fact, is a wonderful tool to promote their own agenda. So the Ahmadinejad regime, who's the guy in charge at the moment, or the president, has kind of, he has his own blog, which he doesn't write on very often. It's pretty crap, but he does have his own blog, which is more than one can say for, you know, Kevin Rudd or George Bush or Gordon Brown. Now, I'm not comparing them. All I'm saying is that it's interesting how there are far more politicians in, say, Iran who are engaged on their own blogs than you would find in any arguably Western country. It's quite extraordinary. Now, maybe in Australia at least, yeah, obviously there are some politicians that have websites and have blogs, there are, but the majority of the top leadership here don't on either side of politics, Labor or Liberal. The Greens do more so. But yes, there are many conservatives who have blogs, they have websites, and also I think there's a sense in Iran, especially since the Islamic Revolution in 79, of actually fostering a push of Islam across the world. That's part of the ideology, to try and spread Islam. And the web, of course, is a wonderful tool to do that. And there are many, many people in the Middle East, especially since the Iraq War, which has been one of the great beneficiaries for Iran, more so than America would have ever imagined, to actually have access to what the Iranian mindset is thinking or the Iranian regime is thinking. And that kind of thing, of course, can be done through the web. And what's interesting is that many of the websites in Iran, and there's a great deal of filtering, websites that are so-called pornographic are blocked. Now, how that's defined is quite liberal. It's not necessarily pornographic in terms of sex, or that's often blocked too, but political sites, as I give an example in the book, it's a funny one, that if you type into Google in, say, Iran, Dick Cheney, it's blocked. Not because he's American or he's a vice president, but because the word Dick is seen as a problem. If you type in the word Richard Cheney, it's fine. Now, there are thousands upon thousands of these kind of crazy examples, and it's random. So you might type in that today, it doesn't work, and tomorrow it does. And as I say throughout the book, and every country was the same, from China to Syria and elsewhere, one cannot impose a logical system on a system which is inherently illogical. So most governments want a sense of the web.
Including ours, by the way.
Including ours, and that's a very good point. And I did mention that in passing, the fact that there is a growing threat in many Western countries, including Australia, Britain, and the US, of censoring certain words or certain issues that are problematic. And I don't address it in a great deal in the book, but it's something that I think a lot of people in the West are not really aware of. There's just a sense that, well, that stuff happens everywhere else apart from here. And I know that the Rudd government here is talking about censoring child pornography sites. Now, this hasn't happened yet, but I suspect it probably will. And the problem with this is, apart from, you don't get people marching down the street saying, yay to child pornography. Probably not. But the problem with it is that, to me, it's a slippery slope. What happens next? Are we going to have a situation, which I fear that we will, where the government starts to ban sites that are regarded as supporting terrorists, for example? And I frankly don't trust my government or any government to make that decision for me.
I'm with you on that. I'm a big believer in no censorship. But let's talk about Iran. What I'm interested in is, you talked at the beginning and you talk a lot in the book about this perception of Iran that we get through the corporate media in Australia, in the USA, in the UK. There must be bloggers over there that also have an inherent distrust of the US and the US's imperialist intentions. Did you meet any bloggers over there that may not necessarily be supporters of Ahmadinejad, but also are in support of the general principles of them, having the right to have nuclear energy, etc.?
In a word, absolutely yes. And I think many people in the West have absolutely no concept of how the US is loathed throughout the Middle East, especially. Many people have a love of America and the ideal of America, whatever that means. They have this idea that it's a lot of the people who have a chance for freedom and democracy. It's these sort of words don't mean a hell of a lot to some people, but there is a loathing of the US government. And the Bush administration particularly has done wonders to cause America to be hated more than any time in the last 50 years, undoubtedly. There are many Iranians who you meet who are opposed to the regime, who want more freedom of speech, who want freedom of democracy, who want freedom of the press, but they don't want it to come at the barrel of a gun, and they don't want any kind of foreign meddling to help that along, because they fear it's going to make it worse. And there's no doubt that if there's a military strike against Iran by Israel or the US, the regime will be entrenched, and any kind of chance of change will be pushed back for years. There's no doubt about that. So I was interested to also know that, of course, the Iraq war has changed the game as well completely, how many regimes in the Middle East say to their people, you see, you look at Iraq, is that the kind of democracy you guys want? And, of course, everyone looks at it and says, of course not, it's hideous. And it's actually entrenched authoritarian regimes rather than the other way around. It's had the opposite effect of what the Bush administration said it would. Now, that's not particularly surprising to you and me, and to many of your listeners probably, but the fact is that across the Middle East, there was, at least initially, at the beginning of the Iraq war, there was some interest in the fact that what was going to happen after Iraq. There's no doubt that the Bush administration was talking about making Iraq the beginning. It wasn't the end. The idea that if Iraq had gone well, and I use that term in inverted commas, whatever that means, there's no doubt that Iran and Syria were next on the list. Now, that hasn't happened, thankfully, because Iraq was a disaster and remains a disaster, despite what the media may be telling people. But the fact is that many people in Iran, for example, who I spoke to, and Syria and Egypt, said that what the Iraq war actually has done is entrenched their leaders' rule. And, of course, let's not forget that in a place like Egypt, as a good example. Egypt is the second highest recipient of US aid every year after Israel. It's a dictatorship, an authoritarian state that oppresses and tortures its own people. Now, it's difficult to try and reconcile the idea of human rights, democracy and freedom in Egypt, which is not a country you read that much about in terms of these issues, but the fact that it's a very, very brutal regime and imprisons bloggers. Many bloggers are in jail in Egypt for either allegedly offending Islam or allegedly offending Mubarak, who's the leader, has been for the last decades. So it's hard for an average person in Egypt who, when he hears George Bush or Condoleezza Rice or any of these lackeys talking about democracy and freedom, when they look at their country and they sort of say, what kind of freedom do we have? You know, when you're funding my government's repression and you're funding my government's torture. And blogs, I think, and the web in many of these places, despite the fact that only a minority of people are engaged with them in the political process, are actually not so much bringing revolution in terms of overthrowing governments. They're not doing that. What they are doing, though, is putting on the agenda or putting in the public sphere issues that, generally speaking, were always around, that were not given as much prominence before the nature of the web, which by definition, of course, spreads things like wildfire.
So how is the internet being used in countries like Egypt to, you know, try and bring about this kind of political change or raise political awareness? Is it having an effect, or is it just like a mosquito on the arse of a bison?
Well, just to put it this way, is the web on its own in Egypt about to bring down the regime? Definitely not. No chance. But what it is doing, as I said, in places like Egypt, where a good example would be police torture. Now, police torture has been going on in police stations for decades in Egypt. Generally speaking, the last years, for different reasons, a number of men have been arrested on spurious charges, taken to police stations, raped by other men. These policemen film their crimes on mobile phone cameras and distribute this to other people to try and intimidate them. And what's happened in the last years, thanks to the web and blogs particularly, is the fact that a lot of this stuff has got out and it's been placed on blogs. And a lot of bloggers and dissidents and activists have been using this footage to try and pressure the government to take action. In other words, the government says, we don't torture. Sounds like the Americans. We don't torture. Well, the footage gets out, and of course they can see that they do torture. And after years and years and years of protesting and talking about it in the public and having no effect, as soon as these images got out and they were being posted on prominent blogs across Egypt, the government was forced to respond. Now, torture still goes on. Of course it does. But for the first time in many years, a couple of policemen were charged and found guilty and sent to jail for torturing in prison. Now, it's one start. It's not going to change everything, but it's the beginning. And what's interesting is that the kind of effect, I guess, that many of these bloggers are having, who are essentially a very small percentage of the population, many of whom, I guess, say in Egypt as well, are for the Muslim Brotherhood. For those who don't know, Muslim Brotherhood is a Islamic organization. It's the biggest opposition group in Egypt. It's banned officially, but it's very, very powerful. And if there was an open and free election tomorrow in Egypt, there's a good chance that party would do very well if not win the election, hence the government and the West being scared of that. And I think one of the real failings of the post-9/11 environment in a place like Egypt has been the fear of Western countries to engage people who are Islamists. In other words, the idea that if you are a political Islamist, you believe in political Islam, you are seen as a threat. In other words, there's no distinction between Osama bin Laden and a guy in the Muslim Brotherhood in Cairo. Their views could be radically different. But in the Western media, often they're regarded as one and the same thing.
You know, one of the you're right there?
Yes, sorry, yes, please, go on.
You know, some of the notable absences in your book are countries like Iraq and Israel. I was wondering if there was a reason why you didn't visit or cover those countries.
Which ones were they? I missed that. Say that again. Which countries were they?
Iraq and Israel.
Right, yes. Well, Israel I didn't go to because, although I've written about Israel and I still do often, there is actually censorship in Israel of the web. It's not just for the web, though. It's actually a great deal of military censorship against issues that are regarded as being very sensitive. But there wasn't really... I didn't regard Israel, well, this might sound strange, as a repressive regime. I couldn't cover everything, so I chose not to do it this time. Again, with Iraq... Iraq is an interesting case. I probably would have gone to Iraq if the security situation was a little bit better. The Iraqi blogosphere exploded after 2003. It certainly died down a lot in the last few years as the violence, you know, just became out of control. I have a few friends of mine who are very close to many Iraqi bloggers, both based in Iraq and elsewhere. And I read many of those Iraqi bloggers all the time. But again, there wasn't really a sense yet of a organized infrastructure of blocking, filtering, or imprisoning bloggers. Now, there is some censorship, and there's a great deal of, I mean, Iraq is still very much a failed state, so there's a sense that we're still trying to work out how these issues are going to work in, you know, in terms of freedom of the press. I just noticed a few days ago that in Iraqi Kurdistan, which is in the north, they just implemented a new rules in terms of journalist freedoms. They're not perfect, but they're certainly better than existed before, and that sort of thing I think is an encouraging sign that in some parts of Iraq anyway, a degree of, not normality, but at least in Iraqi Kurdistan, the north was always the most stable of the whole country, even when the rest of the country was in civil war, is getting a bit better. But you know, a lot of people said, you know, why didn't I go to Burma or North Korea? And I couldn't go everywhere, I guess was the answer to that question. And also, I chose other countries because, for me, they were interesting examples or extreme examples of what I was writing about. And in North Korea, say, the web doesn't really exist, point one. And two, getting in there would have been virtually impossible. Even if you get into North Korea, you can't do anything independently. I've known a few journalists who have been there. It literally is impossible to go anywhere in North Korea on your own. It's impossible. You can't do it. To the point where people literally will be staying outside, like standing outside your hotel room every night just in case you try to get out. I mean, it's that full on in North Korea. And in Burma, well, Burma, of course, interestingly enough, after I came back from overseas, there was the massive uprising in September last year by the monks. And many of the images and those photographs and video that was coming out of Burma was essentially coming from dissidents who were using online tools to spread it to the world. And the reaction of the regime, eventually when they realized what a bad PR job this was becoming, just literally shut down the internet. They literally shut it down, the whole thing. Now, in a place like China, say, in a place like China, you simply can't do that. Even though there's massive repression and censorship of the web, the internet in China has become so integral to that country's development now and economic strength. You just can't shut it down. In Burma, you can, and the regime did for a number of days. The internet was just literally shut down. So, therefore, no one could send anything out or receive anything. So I guess the effect was what the regime wanted. But again, these kind of things, one of the things I talk about in the book is that there is really a need now for international understanding to try and help people in those countries overcome those problems. So, yes, if the internet shuts down, I guess if it was shut down entirely in Australia as well, there'd be a problem. That's true. But it needs to be. There are many tools that have been developed now, both in many Western countries, to help activists and dissidents in non-democratic countries to access the web if there's a great deal of censorship. If the internet system itself is shut down, that's the problem. Unless, of course, one can access satellite connection, which the average person, of course, simply can't afford. Mm. But it was, I think it's important that many people realise that there's a great movement now in many Western countries to provide assistance to people in non-Western countries, programs like Tor, amongst others, to circumvent censorship and filtering, which I might add, as I talk about in the book, in relation to China especially, is often assisted by Western multinationals like Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft.
The same companies that are supporting governments like China to censor bloggers?
Say that again, sorry.
The same companies that are supporting governments like China to censor bloggers.
Absolutely. I mean, what's one of the things I think that struck me about writing this book and is that in much of the Western world, we still regard companies like Google as a benevolent company. In other words, we say, these guys have been around for 10 years. They've obviously done amazing things. There's no doubt Google is an incredible company. It's done, helped society in many, many years it has. However, also Google, like any other company, has done very bad things, not least of which is colluding with the Chinese Communist Party to censor the internet. This sort of stuff isn't particularly well known. Yahoo and Microsoft and many other Western security firms have gone into China, and they use China in some ways as a laboratory. The regime says to them, you guys can come in here and do whatever you want, as long as you censor the internet or you block certain keywords or whatever it may be. Now, that to me is problematic because there's no transparency whatsoever. And more importantly, it should force us in the West to think about what is all the information that Google has on us? What is it, what is it doing with it? Now, we don't really know the answer to that. Google claims that there's no reason we shouldn't trust them. Now, frankly, I wouldn't trust Google more than I trust anybody else. Having said that, we all use Google. Most of us use Gmail. Many of us use Gmail. And interestingly enough, in terms of web-based email, Gmail is probably the safest with the most inbuilt forms of protection in many repressive regimes. Yahoo and Hotmail often are blocked, and Gmail thus far is not. That'll probably change when the regimes catch on that Gmail is becoming very popular. But I'm told it's the most encrypted web-based email system that's out there, in terms of the main ones anyway. But one of the things I talk about in the book is looking at how Yahoo, Microsoft and Google are behaving, especially in China. And it's been appalling. I mean, Yahoo's classic case was a few years ago, a Chinese journalist was writing a story for a Western online publication about human rights. The regime found out. They went to Yahoo. They found out this guy had a Yahoo email account. They went to Yahoo and said, what's this guy's details? Yahoo gave it to them. And this guy is now in jail for 10 years. His name is Shi Tao. Now, there are many examples like this, and Yahoo was given hell for doing that. Now, in my view, rightly so. I suspect, though, it wasn't so much that they had gone to China and fully thought out the ramifications of doing so. I'm not excusing Yahoo at all. What I'm saying is that I think there was a great deal of excitement about, wow, massive new market, let's go to China. Of course, the day-to-day realities of that are quite different, and the realities are that the regime may well come to you and say, we want information about this dissident or that dissident. What Yahoo, pardon me, failed to understand was that they had housed their servers within China itself. So they had a lot less ability to be able to say no when the regime came knocking. Google, on the other hand, obviously Gmail is very popular in China, but the servers for Gmail are not in China. Now, the theory behind that is that Google did not want to have the same problem that Yahoo did, i.e. the regime comes to them and says, can you give us this information? They don't have to do it. Now, their search engine is severely blocked. You can go to google.cn. There are thousands upon thousands and thousands of keywords and phrases that are blocked. No one actually knows what they are. There's no list, but when you can't access words like, well, it's not just human rights, Tiananmen Square, democracy, freedom, blah, 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 those words, but many, many others. And to me, one of the concerning things is, and China in some ways is the extreme example of this, are the tools and the experience that companies like Yahoo, Google, and Microsoft are learning in places like China, will they then be used and brought back to the West or other authoritarian regimes? And the fact is they probably will be. And we have virtually no discussion in our own countries about what these companies that we use every day are doing over there, and will they bring it back to us?
Hmm. I guess the argument that we see from companies like Google, Microsoft, regarding their participation in these schemes in China is that they believe that there's a trade-off where the people are getting access to information and to other online sources, which is good for the people, good for freedom, democracy, even though there's certain limits on what they can get.
Yeah.
Do you buy that argument?
Yes and no. When I went there, I didn't buy it so much. And when I got there and speaking to many people in a place like China, there was a general consensus, I have to say, that many people, although they were very critical of Yahoo, especially because they had given that information to the regime that puts people in jail, that's pretty bad. And pretty extreme, frankly. Google, though, was generally regarded in a fairly positive light. People were saying, well, yes, we wish they didn't censor their internet search engine, but they do. And generally speaking, it's given us more information. That was a general sense. And I should also say that in a place like China, the vast majority of Western internet firms aren't very popular anyway. The majority of popular websites in China are all Chinese-based. So Google has a presence there, and it's not that small. But it's not that big either, excuse me. And I think for many people, there's a sense of wanting to sort of keep it in the family, so to speak, so using Chinese companies. And also a belief that Chinese companies are more likely to understand the market more so than Western companies will. Interestingly enough, if the study after study after study of Chinese web users has found assuming these are accurate, and one has to presume that they are, that the majority of Chinese web users actually support the idea of internet censorship to some extent. They support the idea that the government filtering certain websites. Now, that doesn't mean that the Chinese people like to be oppressed. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that there is a supposed belief that the internet, if it's allowed to be uncensored, will corrupt the young, and that's said quite openly. So therefore, certain sites, either pornographic sites, sexual sites, or many political sites, are blocked. And there doesn't seem to be, with exceptions, a great deal of outrage about this. Now, that kind of thing is difficult for many of us in the West to understand. But the system in China is so different. And I think one of the things I try to do in the book is to sort of say, yes, a lot of people in China would like more openness. And we see that more and more now with greater protests about corruption, particularly. China is changing, and I think it's changing for the better, despite profound human rights abuses, which exist and they're real, and I'm not trying to deny that or minimize them. But China is opening up, and the fact is that in the last sort of 5 years or 10 years, the web has actually allowed people to discuss issues and organize in ways that were not possible before. So a good example would be this recent milk powder scandal in China, where tens of thousands of babies have been affected by contaminated milk powder. Now, the regime is getting it in the neck about this, rightly so, because there's virtually no regulation, there's massive amounts of corruption. People sort of saying, how the hell is my government allowing this milk to be allowed to be fed to my child? The web and bloggers have organized petitions. There's been protests in the streets. There's been angry bloggers who are criticizing the regime. Now, no one's coming out and saying, down with the one-party state. They're not saying that. But what they are saying is there's a great deal of anger about saying, can we trust our government? Now, the fact that people were saying that 50 years ago, but they weren't saying in such a public forum. And the web and the regime, to some extent, I guess, has allowed... I see the web as a sort of safety valve, you could say, with restrictions. And many people have argued, as they do in the book as well, that the web in some ways actually has allowed the Chinese regime to be more informed about what society is seeking than ever before. There's about 1.3, 1.4 billion people in China. About 250 million of those are online. There are 6 million new users going online every month. So yes, it's still a minority of people. But nonetheless, it's a lot of people. And they are actually able to read information and see information the regime can, to the point where they can get a pretty good sense of what people are saying out there, and they're trying to react to a growing anger about corruption, whether it's about milk or after the earthquake in May, whatever it may be. So the regime is pretty clever, and you know, if you ask me, I think China should be a multi-party democracy, but the fact is that many people who I met, even those who are critical of the regime, they sort of say, is China actually ready for a multi-party state or multi-party environment? And that's a question which we should talk about in the West as well, because we, I think, too often like to impose our own values on how China should be as opposed to how it might want to be itself.
That reminds me of what you were saying about Cuba. I found the chapter on Cuba quite challenging because I'm one of these people that I think you berate in the chapter on Cuba as being a supporter of the revolution and Castro. Yep. Even though I certainly don't think Castro is a saint by any means, I do admire the way that he has kept the Americans and American interests out of Cuba since 1959.
Yep.
But there's no denying that they have a lot of problems, in part caused by the economic embargo imposed on them by America. But what is fascinating is, firstly, I found in your chapter, you're talking about the very low penetration of internet access in Cuba. And people just aren't, you said people just aren't aware of blogging?
Generally speaking, I mean, Cuba was an interesting case where, as I say at the beginning, that, I mean, I'm someone of the left, and I've often over the years been supportive of a lot of things that the revolution did too. Having said that, the focus of this project, of course, was more freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of association. And Cuba, for different reasons, often fails on those counts. Now, having said that, the US embargo and the pressure from the US has been undeniably insane, criminal, counterproductive, and has given the regime justification over decades to crack down on its own people. There's no doubt about that. So the embargo plays a big part in that. Having said that, there's also an undeniable reality that the regime, Castro particularly, has never dealt well with open debate. Now, people often say, well, Castro believes in debate. He believes in debate on some things where people generally agree with him. Now, when it comes to freedom of the press, it doesn't exist. I mean, if you go to Cuba and read the press there, it's a joke. I mean, it's essentially just printing government propaganda. The internet in Cuba is very, very underdeveloped. Whereas in a place like Iran or Egypt, for example, where the regimes years ago, about 5 years ago, actually recognized the economic potential of the web, they didn't so much fear the political dissent. They may have been naive. So much of the initial investment in the web in Iran and Egypt, for example, came from the government. In Cuba, it was the opposite. The Cuban regime decided years ago that, and they often blame the US embargo for not being able to get the right hardware. There's some truth in that, but it's more complicated. Now, they were fearful of the web opening the island up. Basically, they were fearful of the island being opened up to, I guess, US spying. Now, again, all legitimate concerns, but the reasons often that were given, I think, justified the fact that Cuba now, even with the new president, Raul Castro, who is opening things up slowly, allegedly, is fearful of what the internet could do. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is that, you know, television for decades was a central part of Cuban society because the regime often gave TVs to people for free because the television is a static thing that every day or every few days governments can make pronouncements on television that people watch and they listen or they don't. The internet, of course, is a different thing. It's interactive and the regime doesn't like the idea of that too much. Now, it's changing there. It's changing. And one of the things that struck me over there was I was very careful not to, hopefully, I was very careful not to write about Cuba in a way that simply said, well, Cuba's system is ruined, it's screwed, it should change and open up to the world. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that many people in Cuba, in fact, support the system, they support the regime. There's no doubt about that. Young people, a little bit less. I think, as I talk about in the book, it's not surprising that if you're a young person in Cuba and you're studying, as some people I met did, information technology, you're studying the internet, but you can't access the internet. Now, you can access an intranet, which is a internal system where the regime chooses what sites you see. Some people get pissed off, understandably.
It sounds like people working in any Australian government agency, mate. Most of them, even the ones that work in the online divisions, can't access YouTube videos or podcasts still.
Well, that's
have instant messenger turned off.
Yeah. Well, I take that point. But it's not quite the same you can't access a lot of the web. I mean, you can't access those websites. I mean, that's outrageous. But it's different to not being able to access, most of the internet.
Yeah, I was being facetious.
I know.
You quote a Gallup poll taken in 2006 where they interviewed 1,000 people living in Havana and Santiago in Cuba that found that while 40% of the people disapproved of the performance of Cuba's leadership, it says the majority were satisfied with their personal freedom to choose what they did with their lives.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And that's, you would assume a Gallup poll is unbiased by, Cuban communist propaganda.
Well, probably. Again, it's in any authoritarian state, and I talk about this throughout the whole book, it's very often hard to gauge what an average person thinks because public polling doesn't really happen that widely. So, yes, that poll was an interesting one. As I say, the evidence seems to suggest that a lot of Cubans are fairly satisfied with their regime. What they aren't that satisfied with is, of course, great poverty, an inability often to find work. The priority is not to get online. I mean, I don't see anywhere in the world that, people's first job is, I want to check YouTube. I mean, it's not. But what is starting to happen, I think, in many places, it is a sense, and from dissidents as well, that it's more the ability to be able to or be allowed to actually have these debates in the first place. And one of the things that the regime has been very successful in doing, the Cuban regime, Castro, both Fidel and now Raul, is actually implementing a kind of a system whereby any kind of dissent is regarded as challenging their rule. I mean, what I think Cuba's moving towards, more likely, under Raul Castro, is kind of like a China model, where you have a quasi-free market system of sorts. I mean, China has a free market. It's essentially a capitalist country on one level, but incredible political repression. So one of the great things that the regime in China has successfully done for its own people, according to its people anyway, is they brought up hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Many of them are still there, but they brought many of them up from poverty. The country economically is fairly strong, but politically, of course, although it's opening up, it's still very repressed. And Cuba may well be going in the same direction. Many regimes look at China and they say, this is the perfect model. We can stay in power, arguably forever, but we can open up our countries to free market system, which kind of works. Now, you could argue in China, I would argue it doesn't work that well because, as we see, the lack of regulation and corruption in China is on a massive scale. And one of the reasons China's become so successful is that essentially most of the stuff that, the West and the world gets, product-wise, is all coming from China. What's going to start happening in years to come is if products keep on coming out of China, like, say, milk powder for babies, which is regarded as contaminated, we're going to look for other markets, and China's not going to be our primary importer anymore. So I think China has to be aware of that, and I know that they are. But in Cuba, I think, may well go in the same direction. And Raul Castro, the new president, has made some encouraging signs of opening things up. In terms of politically, though, look, it's hard to say what's going to happen there, but I suspect that the system won't change a great deal. The internet, though, is starting to appear more widely there. And I think one of the things that we can do in the West is rather than simply berating Cuba as a dictatorship, actually trying to engage with people who live there and to sort of both those for the regime and against the regime, to try and talk to people there. And there's too much in the West, I think, often of talking past people rather than actually engaging with people. I found this months ago with the Olympics in Beijing where, you know, there was massive protests about the torch relay and Tibet, all totally justified protests against the hideous things China's doing. In China itself, many people were upset that they felt that the West was against them because they didn't like the fact that China was an up-and-coming power. There was like two ships in the night. They're shouting at us, we're shouting at them. There's no middle ground, and here we are a few months after, and that feeling is still very much there in China, having read the blogs, as I do quite regularly. So it's important, I think, one of the things that blogs can do, and obviously language is a barrier, but there's like bridge, you know, there's ways to kind of bridge that problem, is to actually start engaging with people in different countries and seeing what they think. And they may well say things you think is appalling or hideous and vice versa, but there's no other way to me to get past it. One of the great limitations of the internet at the moment still with language. Language is one of the great problems of the web where, generally speaking, the English world is on one side and the rest of the world is on the other side. And if you speak English, as obviously all of us do, you rarely, if ever, engage with most of the world because most of the world doesn't speak English and vice versa. So one of the challenges, I think, for the web, whether it's 3.0 or whatever, you know, wherever the web is going, is trying to break that down because unless we want to just talk to each other or talk to ourselves, which is kind of very nice, those issues have to be overcome. And there are certainly individuals, particularly in America, who are trying to bridge those issues, both through language and also just to sort of say, to try and find ways to communicate with people in non-Western countries to hear what they have to say, which is such an obvious thing to say, and yet it doesn't happen very often at the moment.
There are sites like Global Voices Online, which translate international language blogs into English.
Global Voices is the best example of that I know. I talk about them quite a lot in the book. I went to a conference there a few months ago in Hungary. Yeah, Global Voices is a great site, which translates blogs from all over the world. It's a great beginning, and it's no criticism of them at all, but it's one site, and I think there needs to be a lot more of that. But no, it's a great initiative, very good initiative.
So I wanted to finish with a couple of things. I wanted to ask you about sources where people can go and read some of these international bloggers that you've been reading and engaging with.
Yeah.
I couldn't find I know that in the book, in the index in the book, you've got a list of blogs which runs for many pages. I couldn't see that on the Blogging Revolution website, though. Am I missing it somewhere?
That's a very good question. There's not on the website. There are certainly places that I have on my own website, which is just antilowenstein.com. There are links within the bloggingrevolution.com, which is the book's website where that exists. There's also many interviews that people just Google the Blogging Revolution stuff comes up as well. And the back of the book has that too. We are going to put that list on the website shortly. People often sort of say to me in the last while, how do I find blogs in Iran? It's a good question. There's no simple answer to that. Global Voices is one good start. It's only one example, though. I think one of the things that people can do is, I mean, it could be as simple as an event happens and they can just go into Google News and type Iran bloggers. You'd be amazed what stuff comes up, or Saudi Arabian bloggers. I mean, information's out there. There's a good example. It's a great site called SaudiJeans.org, which is written by a Saudi blogger in Riyadh, which is one of the big cities in Saudi Arabia. And he writes in English and Arabic, but the English website is more relevant for us. And he's a fairly liberal guy who's often critical of the regime, but also critical of the US. And it's sites like that, which are actually quite popular and known around the world, but not so much in many Western countries. He talks about what life is like in Saudi Arabia for a young, single man who's in his mid-20s. So that's a good example. And there are many of those kind of sites around, but all those are listed in the book, but also on my website too.
And finally, you know, we've mentioned throughout the chat that the role that Western governments play in funding oppressive regimes like in Egypt, or the role that Western media plays in creating a certain perception of the governments of Cuba or Iran, which are very biased to Western corporate media interests. Yeah. In terms of the blogging revolution, where does the responsibility lie for those of us in the West, in countries like the US and Australia and the UK and New Zealand, Canada, where I'm often kind of depressed when I go to blogging conferences and I meet other bloggers and I go to digital media events, or I run digital media events,
yeah,
and everyone's just talking about the MacBook Air or the iPhone.
Yeah,
and I'm constantly saying to people, do you realize that we have the greatest gift that has ever been given to the human race, to the proletariat, for creating political and social change? And, you know, we're masturbating into a sock over iPhones.
iPhone, yeah, no. Look, you know what? My response to that is I agree. hence, I guess, writing the book, and hence trying to write about this stuff around the place. I think one of the problems is that, as in the last sort of 5-10 years, how, you know, the computer revolution, so to speak, has become sort of mainstream, that people can get their rocks off about the iPhone, which is a very nice toy, don't get me wrong. But I think one of the problems is that the Western media has allowed that to happen, whereas spaces for international news in most papers is declining. It's easier to ignore what's going on in the world unless it supposedly affects us. So, you know, the Iraq war, for example, doesn't get much play in the media anymore, although the war there is still going appallingly badly. To me, the only way to get around that is to either harass the media, if you enjoy doing that, to try and get more views out there, or you go online and find sites that do it for you, whether in, you know, Western countries or blogs or whatever. And as cliche as it might sound, I don't sort of see myself as a web evangelist much, but I think it's important that the only way that the Western media will actually change, I think I used to believe that it could change from within, so one would enter an organisation and try and change it. I don't believe that so much anymore. I mean, the major companies exist, Fairfax or News Limited. They're going to exist for a while, and you can't ignore them just by virtue of the fact that they have massive audiences and they reach a lot of people. So it's not unimportant what they say. It's very important what they say. But it's also important, I think, to support alternative media as well, particularly in countries where it's more difficult to do so. And that's one of the things I try and say in the book, is to sort of say, do not rely anymore, or don't just get frustrated with how bad our media is. Actually go out there and find out what exists. It's actually not as difficult as people think. My sense has been that in the last months, a lot of people actually are scared of just making that first step. Now they sort of say, I know our media is crap about the world, but I'm not quite sure how to find out what to do about it. Now, that to me is sort of shouting out for being more proactive and find out. But if they haven't got the ability or the time or whatever it may be, there are ways to help people to do that. And hopefully my book is one way about that, but there's many other ways too, to go online. And I think one of the things that's happening more and more is that the trust that the average person has towards the Western media has never been lower. Many people may still engage the Sydney Morning Herald, they may still engage the New York Times every day or whatever. A lot of people still read those publications. But how people view them and the trust they feel towards them has never been lower. And that, to me, is a perfect opportunity for online media and alternative media to get out there and say, look, you know, we're not going to say we're going to replace the New York Times. We haven't got those kind of resources. But the fact is that at the moment we have a crisis in funding, and I'm very much of the belief, and I should say I don't support the idea of paying lots of money for good journalism. Having said that, at the moment the problem is that the best journalism, generally speaking, still requires time, energy, and money. You know, the best journalists are generally paid, not all of them, but most of them are, and it takes time to find good stories and to write good stories. So my view has been for a while that although the idea of free information is really important, and I think that's even more important in the non-Western world than it is in our world, the bottom line still, I think, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, is that how do you support people who are doing interesting journalism, even if they're not working for the mainstream? They have to get paid in some way, some kind of remuneration in some way. And I suppose that kind of thing means to me that sort of new subscription models are likely to come up. What they're going to look like, I don't really know. But I'm not really of the belief that, you know, the wonders of advertising are going to solve all our problems here. I just don't buy that at all. And I, my ideal would be media with no advertising at all. That to me is the ideal situation. But how likely that is in the long run, I'm not really sure. But no, to me, alternative media is actually the only way forward. And not that I believe that the mainstream media should die. It shouldn't. It has its, the resources it has still are important. But to be aware of the biases that exist within them.
I spoke on a panel at the MEAA's Future of Journalism conference a couple of weeks ago up here in Brisbane. And I had to remind the audience at one stage that the vast majority of human history, we haven't had journalism, and, you know, we survived quite fine. Journalism and media as we think of it today is a relatively new construct. We didn't have it for the vast majority of human history. It's I think a lot of times when we have these discussions, we assume that journalism is like water and oxygen, that we have to have it. And the truth is that we didn't. You know, we had people talking to each other.
True, but of course, how do you go back to that when you have what you have now?
Well, that's, you know, when I get into these blogging versus journalism debates all the time, usually with journalists, I point out that I'm not a journalist. I would be horrified if anyone ever suggested that I am a journalist. I'm just somebody who talks to people. And, you know, that I reckon the majority of bloggers don't consider themselves journalists, don't aspire to be journalists. They're just people talking about their fears, hopes, and dreams.
Maybe that
is the future. Maybe it isn't a journalism-based media future. Maybe it's just people talking to people. Anthony Lowenstein, thank you so much for coming on and chatting. And again, thank you for the book, man. It's a terrific read. I think it's a very important read. And, you know, I would love to see a book of this ilk actually looking at how we use blogging and podcasting and Twitter to bring about revolutionary change in countries like our own.
I agree with that. So maybe I'll still do another one. But, yeah, thank you for the chance for the chat. It's been great, Cameron.